Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. Today on All Access Pass, we have an interview with Rachel Sullivan. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Hey.
And joining me today for interviewing, it will be Nicole. And as many of you know, I am Jordan. Yeah. Welcome to the show. All right. So the first question we have for you, Rachel, is, well, who is Rachel Sullivan?
Oh, good question. So I'm a white cisgender settler. I was born and raised in Northern Ontario, and my family is mostly Canadian, and then our heritage is mostly Irish and Scottish with a little bit of English in there. So really strong in the Celtic frame. I'm queer, I have a learning disability, and I also live with a chronic illness and chronic fatigue. So so I have lots of interests, and I've been at the University of British Columbia. I came in 2005 as a student. I was doing my PhD in sociology. And then when I finished, I taught for a couple of years, and then I got a job at the Equity and Inclusion Office. And I've been there ever since 2014.
Awesome. If you don't mind telling us a little bit more about your disability, we'd love to hear about just some held and whatever you're comfortable with sharing.
Of course. So one of the things that is really interesting in my life with disability is that it has often been around education. So as a kid, other than being slightly not very well coordinated, I would trip and fall and run into things all the time. I always had bruised legs. Where I really ran into trouble was with reading and writing. And I have a very distinct memory of grade one, and my mom is trying to get me to figure out which way a B, printed B goes, and which way a printed D goes. And I mean, I would make P's, Q's, G's, being a ball and a stick, it could stand in for anything for me. And so what had happened is that it wasn't until I got to high school that one of the teachers who helped to support other students who had different kinds of learning disabilities and ADHD and things like that, he said to me, "Rachel, you're really good in class. You know how to answer the questions, but when it comes to reading your work, it's not that great." And this disconnect says that there's actually something else going on here. I don't think that you're lazy. I don't think that you don't understand what's going on, but there's something's not quite right. And so he was able to do like a kind of mini study where a bunch of my high school teachers were given a kind of assessment form, and they were asked to report on my work and really get kind of into, what were the differences between the ways I showed up and answered questions in class versus the kind of written work that I provided. And from there, what had happened was they determined that it would be good for me to get tested for a learning disability. The problem was that my family did not have the extra $1,500 kind of kicking around to make that happen. So what the school did was said, you know what, you don't qualify for funding because your grades are too high. So I was like a solid B plus, A minus student. And so they just gave me extra time for tests. That was tests and exams, extra time. And then when I went to university, so there's a really important thing about university. It was my way out of Sudbury, Ontario. So like no dissing my family who's still there, including my sister. It's a great city, but I knew I wanted kind of other things, and I knew that going to university was going to be the way that I would get them. So when I went to Laurentian University, which was our local university, I had gone to the disability office there and said, like, I've never been tested formally. I think I might need accommodations. Can you help me? And one of the advisors there gave me an IQ test and said, well, I don't want you to have the stigma of having a learning disability, and you'll probably do, you know, okay. So rather than, you know, have the stigma of having a disability, you know, just do the best you can. And I was like, okay. I transferred because my family moved from Sudbury to Thunder Bay, and I then ended up going to Lakehead University, and I asked them the same thing, and they said, based on your paperwork, we can't do anything. And I thought, oh man, okay. So I was lucky that I had a couple of really good champion faculty members that supported me, and I decided graduate school was like my dream. And so I applied to three other universities, and two in Southern Ontario and UBC actually. And I got into the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education. And, you know, one of the things about my learning disability is that I had created enough strategies, enough workarounds that I could manage. So I always tried really hard when it was like the oral presentation, any kind of group work, you know, I was in there, and that's where I really gave my effort. And then when it came to the writing and like writing tests, exams, writing essays, you know, I did the best that I could, and I asked for like a lot of help. I would have people read my papers, all that kind of stuff, because I couldn't see my own mistakes. And then when I went to graduate school, the mode of learning changed. I couldn't rely on the lecture because there really wasn't a lecture anymore. And in the first semester, I remember, put in all of my papers, like it was like pulling teeth to get them done and to the level that they needed to be at. And one of my faculty members kind of pulled me aside and said, this is not the quality that we expect. And I said, I know, I have an undiagnosed learning disability. And she said, please, now OISE is a part of U of T. She said, please go to the basically their version of the Center for Accessibility at U of T. And I did. And there was a fabulous advisor. I had this red folder that had all my paperwork in it. And I just like gave it to her, hoping that there would be something she could see. And she said, you know what, based on how you're talking, based on what I see, yeah, you probably do have a learning disability and we need to get you tested. And she said, if you apply for and qualify for student loans, they'll pay for it. I was beside myself. So we did it. I applied for funding. I was able to get just enough so that the tests would be paid for. And then they tested me. And it was really interesting what came about from those tests. So what I learned was that I have an issue with my working memory. So instead of sounding the words out, I actually sight read. So transportation and transformation look about the same to me. So I have to really pay attention to the context of a sentence, a paragraph, so on. I still can't see my own mistakes in my writing. And when I'm really tired, it really shows up. So knowing that there was a very interesting thing happening between my auditory understanding. So I rely a lot on my listening skills. And when words don't sound like words, there's like one part of the test that was like, it was exhausting, was made up words. And I had to be able to spell them based on how they sounded. I honestly couldn't do it. and it said it told me a lot about, you know, where my strengths, but then where those gaps were in my learning. So that's the story behind my learning disability and the ways that I've needed to, accommodate, self-accommodate through most of my graduate school work. I've gotten support in some ways, if I had been diagnosed earlier, I probably would have had a different set of support and a different set of strategies. And yet here I am, you know, still finished my doctorate, still work for the university. Like I'm still very much in wanting to be in this space. So that's like a pretty long story about just my learning disability. When it comes to my chronic illness and chronic fatigue. So a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and it's kind of not surprising that that happened kind of post PhD. And part of it is that the PhD can be so stressful that my poor nervous system just was kind of undone by the stress of it all. The good thing is, even though it took me 7 years to do it, those last 2 years where I was really full-time writing were actually some of the best years, because I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about my work ethic and what I can do and what I can't do. And that was valuable, almost invaluable in terms of that experience. So unfortunately, it does mean that my body doesn't work quite the same way. I get tired and winded in ways and at times that I kind of forget, because I'll be kind of like, you know, doing my everyday things. And then like a really good example is yesterday I woke up and I could tell right away something wasn't quite right. So I was also diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis, and it really affects the joints in my hands. And I had really puffy knuckles, and I was like, oh, okay, I know what kind of day it's going to be. It's going to be a kind of slow day. I need to, you know, take a lot of the pressure of like getting things done off. And if I do a lot of resting, tomorrow might be a better day. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't you know it, after 9 hours of sleep, I feel so much better today. So these are just kind of some of the things that I deal with in terms of trying to get my mind and my body, you know, ready for work, you know, to be able to play with my dog and to like go for walks and hang out with my partners.
I love your story. It's like very, very detailed and very like it covered all the bases. And I just like got a very good look at like just your disability, your life, and just everything all together. It's great.
Is there really any story that you can kind of sum up really quickly though? Like, you know, my disability story is I can try to make it short, but honestly, yeah. Like, I feel like I'm not telling you like my story. So, yeah.
So I would say the story of my disability is one of discovery. It wasn't noticeable. Often when people meet me, they don't know. And the signs that I know, so my learning disability comes out in the ways that, you know, I write. So writing emails, I mix up my words. Sometimes the sentence itself is inside out. And when it comes to my physical disability, the kind of cloudiness that comes with a foggy brain, that comes with living with pain and with fatigue, means that, you know, there's some funny things that can arise, including spoonerisms, which I'm actually really good at. So that's when you take the first letter of the second word and you replace the first letter in the first word with it, and you flip them. And so, you know, I like to find a lot of humor in the ways that I kind of move through the world and see the world, because if I can't laugh, I'm afraid I'd be crying a whole lot more. So
I totally relate to that. Like, I have a hearing loss, and so like sometimes I hear things very incorrectly, and it's just a hoot sometimes when you repeat them and other people like are like, what? And I'm like, I know you didn't say that, but that's just like what I heard. And I agree, like sometimes you just have to like laugh at it, because like, I don't know, just I agree. I'd probably be really sad the entire time if I didn't have a little bit of a sense of humor about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In your opinion, how can professors and staff better support students at UBC with disabilities?
Oh, that's a good question. CTLT, the Center for Teaching, Learning, and Technology, has a Canvas course called, I believe it's called Inclusive Learning. I can send you the link. It's a five-part course that outlines not only universal design as like a way to create inclusive classrooms and ways of teaching, but it really outlines a couple of different things. And I tend to rely on that myself, and I share it with people. So when professors and instructors are setting up their classes, making sure there's lots of choice, that's one of the principles of universal design. And then access, I would say, would be the next one. And so I was recently a student in a different program, and one of the things I noticed is that what I needed were texts that could be text to speech that could be read by there's like a number of really good programs out there, including some free ones. And every once in a while, I would come up across a PDF that either wasn't saved in the right format, or the actual text itself was like a poor reproduction. So the text to speech readers wouldn't be able to catch it. And so to be thinking about not only the course design, and I can say that as a former instructor myself, but then also making sure that the materials are accessible in whatever format is needed, connecting with the Center for Accessibility would be a great way to support, to find that support for setting up resources for assistive technology.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, I totally agree, especially just having, like, as a student and with COVID especially, it makes it very apparent that there needs to be other avenues of accessing your courses. Even if, like, you know, you can't get to class, it really highlights, like, with disabled students not having access to their courses before, just having more avenues to get to your class and learn, it's just so much more useful. As we kind of keep going.
That's right. And learning happens in different ways for different people. And one of the things that I find for my own learning process is that I need the big picture. I need the lecture first, and then I want to read because I can actually put the details in the right spots. But if I start with the reading in that deep dive, then I'm going to miss how to organize it. And that's something that just works really well for me. And so to keep that in mind when people are designing their courses or those kinds of things.
Can I actually take a step back and ask you, how did you get into like the work that you do, and why did you choose like education, and like what drove you really?
Why did you do it? That's a good question. I think that I have always loved learning. Being smart in my family was really, like, it was a good thing. It was praised. The other thing is that sometimes, especially when I was a little kid, sometimes being at school was better than being at home. You know, lots of things going on, including like new sisters showing up on the scene. So sometimes it was like just nicer to be at school. And then the other thing is, I saw school as a pathway into, you know, maybe doing some traveling, maybe doing some other things, writing a book, perhaps. As I moved through my academics, I realized that the university campus was a unique space. And so as part of my doctorate, I actually looked at how queer and trans students understood and navigated the campus as a queer space. And I chose UBC as the site. And so, you know, not that I would encourage people to go read a, you know, 300-page dissertation. There are some really colorful maps in there. And the project, I think, was a success. Now, it was based in 2009, 2010. So, you know, with the findings, if we were to reproduce the study now, probably wouldn't find the same things. I think we're using space differently. And I would say even before the pandemic and then now kind of mid or as we're moving from pandemic to endemic, I say, you know, there's been a real drastic shift in how we're using spaces, how people are moving through the campus. And the pandemic, I think, has really highlighted some of the gaps in, you know, whether it was in programming or infrastructure or those kinds of things. But also, just to come back to the question, my desire to make where I work and where I learn better rather than, you know, just continuing the status quo, I think has been a really strong driver.
Perfect. So for next question, what's your day-to-day life as an equity education strategist?
Oh, good question. It's really different every day. And that's what I like about it. So some days I'm working to help design different online courses, and I use the term course very loosely. So, you know, one of the projects that I've been really excited about is transitioning our positive space education from in-person sessions to online. And part of that is to ensure people have access. And then the colleagues that I've worked with on that course who have just made it that much better have really thought about access and universal design as we developed it. So it's a course that you can move through and you can go to where you want to learn more, what excites you. There are a ton of resources that you can link out to and explore. So it's really a lovely exploratory learning space. Other days I'm having meetings, I'm supporting, I typically work with students in a work-learn capacity, and we work on different projects, whether it's educational design. Sometimes I'm preparing, workshop or presentations, and so I like to use different kinds of formats and methods for presenting materials, as well as, I have to say, I really love doing education and facilitation online, which I didn't think that I would, and I actually resisted doing things online for a long time. A colleague of mine would absolutely agree, and yet when it comes to disability, it's less onerous, it's less what's the word I'm trying to find? It doesn't zap me of energy quite as much as in person. And I think pre-pandemic, I probably would have said the opposite. But now I really realize that being in my space and being able to deliver education and using the technological supports and all the, you know, tips and tricks for facilitating online, and then I don't have to get in the car. I don't have to commute to, you know, back to the office or, you know, like it really streamlines what I'm able to do. So it's actually kind of grown my capacity in some ways.
Yeah, I had a similar thing too. I didn't think that I would like online classes as a hard of hearing person, but I felt the same way about having more energy because I could be in my own space and I could block out, you know, extra noise and all that stuff, and I could hone in on like people's voices a bit better. Like, it's just very surprising like what circumstances can come forward out of what we think is a horrible time. And yeah, but never know. I wanted to also ask about what the positive space campaign was, because I don't think a lot of people, like maybe some of our listeners, don't know about it.
Well, that's such a good question. And like, that's definitely a function of being around for so long. So our positive space campaign is 2S LGBTQ IA Plus education and almost like advocacy education workshop. And what we do is we want to make sure that there's a really good learning space that people can come into, especially if they're not sure. Depending on where folks are coming from, one of the things I love about UBC is just it's so diverse. And you know, whether it's students, staff, and faculty coming from international places, or, you know, maybe folks are just coming from Northern BC or across Canada, you know, having a place where we can disrupt some of the myths that people have learned growing up in the neighborhoods and in the families they have, and providing opportunities to learn, you know, what are the kind of common terms that people are using to describe their gender identity, to describe their sexual orientation or sexual identity, as well as, and this has always been kind of like a hot topic, but, you know, pronoun use, and, you know, why do we ask, you know, why do we maybe share our pronouns, which I didn't do at the beginning. I'm Rachel, I use she, her, and hers pronouns. And then, you know, what does it mean to respect and use somebody else's pronouns? And I often say pronouns are just a short form of people's names. And we're often pretty respectful about making sure that we spell people's names right and we pronounce them correctly. And so we want to do the same thing with pronouns. And so that's kind of a small glimpse into the Positive Space campaign. And I'm really excited for the online course to be launched pretty soon.
Lovely. That sounds very interesting. And yeah, I hope that more people kind of get through those workshops. It's very useful for everyone. As well, in your bio, it says that you spearhead the annual Spring Welcome Training Day. Mm-hmm. If you could maybe speak a little on that, as well as with Positive Space, is there any interplay with that going forward in the future? Just as you're kind of involved with both of those initiatives. So
yeah, you know what, I have to say, my bio is out of date. So the Spring Welcome is now, let's see, so it's actually, so I didn't ever spearhead it, but I was one of the contributors. And if we go back to about 2016, 2017, that's when Spring Welcome really came about. And it was an opportunity to bring student leaders together to learn about, you know, what does leadership look like? You know, how do we do that while also being inclusive and being really respectful of the diversity of the students, you know, whether they were first year students coming in or returning students. And then how do we, so let me rephrase that. How do student leaders show up as student leaders? And one of the things that I think was really positive about that education was that it incorporated active bystanding. And that in some ways gave student leaders permission to interrupt, you know, whether people were using stereotypes or microaggressions or other language that was disrespectful or behaviors, to say, no, like, that's not okay. You might be going for this. And this is the language that we use, or, you know, this is what we're modeling, as a way to help build that sense of respect, dignity, and inclusion that I think is really important, part of student life, and so that people feel welcome and that they might eventually feel like they could belong as part of the UBC community. All of that education due to the pandemic has shifted to online, and the holders of that education really are the folks who run Orientations and Imagine Day, which is part and parcel of the Center for Student Involvement and Careers, and they do a fabulous job of that.
Yes, I also want to bring back to you maybe some of your experiences as a student. And I don't know if that shapes some of the initiatives and the workshops that you do, but what was it like being a student at UBC? Like, you spoke about how you struggled with being diagnosed and you struggled with the instructors, but was there anything else of what it was like, or even having to deal with intersectionalities of your identity at UBC?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have to say that where my learning disability in particular kind of intersected with my work as a graduate student is that it was really hard to find like what was the right support because I had only been diagnosed now I'm going to give away some age information. I was only diagnosed in 2004, kind of 2003, 2004. And so I didn't have a way of talking about my learning disability that I felt comfortable with. I felt like a lot of shame. And then asking for what I needed was also something kind of new because I've just had to tough it out. And so trying to think through those pieces was really tough. And I have to say, I was really supported by my committee, my doctoral committee, because they could see just like how much effort I was putting into my proposal, into, you know, all the pieces that need to happen before it's time to do the research. And yet there was still like a question that always hung in the air, like, well, why can't you see the mistakes in your writing? Why can't you just, you know, push a draft through, you know, why do you need a week when it, you know, it might take somebody in just 2 days? And it's because I need the time to be able to absorb, read, understand. And for me, one of the struggles that I really had was like the emotional labor that went into trying to understand, or the best way to put it is to kind of zip apart the Velcro of the feedback that I was getting in order to make me a good scholar, to be able to grow my scholarly voice as an academic, with the judgment that I felt. And I will own that it was very unlikely my committee members were actually judging me, but it was that experience of always feeling like I was never enough because my work was never perfect. It was never, you know, where I wanted it to be, where I, in my mind I could see it being. And so that emotional labor, it was really tiring.
I totally relate to that. Like just being in school for 8-9 years and that emotional toll, and having to kind of like always advocate for yourself and like not always have the answers or solution for the accommodation that you need or foresee what you needed, and always just like fighting. It felt like always having to fight and always having to prove yourself. And I
like an uphill battle.
Recognize, yeah, I recognize what you're saying, like that pull, that emotional draining like pull. But I also like what you say, Velcro. I think that also really stuck with me too, like I had to rip apart that ugly, annoying sounding Velcro. Yeah, exactly.
And I think the other thing that I really want to recognize is that's the system. That's, you know, I think it's my own experience. I think that it's hard to have a, like specifically a learning disability in an institution where learning and writing and reading are the cat's meow. Like that's like kind of the only thing. And in some ways it was like, it was, you know, a struggle. And on the other hand, it also gave great insight to what was working and what wasn't working. And I would value, you know, what would artists do or say in this moment? Like, what are the different modalities that also provide knowledge or, you know, understanding of a particular issue? Like, it just doesn't need to be that narrowly defined reading and writing kind of frame.
Oh, just to kind of jump on that too, I'm going to lead into our next question. So Why do you think accessibility or disability are not the first thought when it comes to, well, with you, when it, in UBC in general, why do you think that accessibility and disability aren't kind of a priority at UBC and other universities around the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I can actually go back to my dissertation to help explain it. So one of the things, because I looked at the spatial relationship of queer and trans students to the university as an institution, one of the things that I did as part of my research was I went to Imagine Day. I'd never been because I came as a graduate student. So I just like for a day did a little bit of like ethnographic work. And I went with a student group. I got permission and went with the student group. And what I realized was that there was a kind of universal imagined student that was the audience that all of the people who were giving presentations and who were leading groups and all of this kind of stuff. There was like this fictitious, universalized student. And the thing that I walked away from was that this is what this system is built for. And so anybody who shows up in a different way that is somehow outside that universalized student experience or student understanding then causes problems for this system because it wasn't built with that in mind. And so when I think about the university as an institution and you know who built it and who was it built for, you know, it was often for religious study and it was often built for men. And one of the amazing facts that I found, because one of the things I need to do is understand how did UBC get to be in Point Grey. Apparently the president at the time had elicited letters from a number of other universities across the world and had asked them, you know, where is the best place to build a university? Is it in the city or is it in the country? I'm paraphrasing. And different university people wrote back and talked about what the values were. And so at the time, so, you know, think we're going back to, I think it was what, 1915?
Around there, something like that.
Yeah, you know, it's just, the goal was to have the university outside the city. So away from the ills of the city, you know, take that for what it is. And this idea that young men, men needed a country. They needed that country air and the space to exercise not only their minds, but also their bodies. So I don't know about you, but already layered in that is a number of assumptions about who that student is.
Yeah.
Wow. I never knew that. That's actually very interesting. I always kind of assumed it was we were on Point Grey for some kind of, I don't know, war thing, just because it was around World War One. So, but no, that's a, wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and then of course, anytime we talk about where the university is located, you know, it's on unceded land of the Musqueam people. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's good that there is more work happening in alignment and in relationship now, but certainly not then.
Oh yeah, 100%. Next question, what advice would you give to students, especially those with disabilities who are entering UBC in their first year?
Ooh, that's a good question. know your resources. So the first thing, please go get registered at the Center for Accessibility. They are one of the ways to ensure that the kinds of accommodations that students need, that they are looking out for students, and it's a great way to help communicate that also with the instructor. So having been on the instructor side of things, I put it in my syllabus because I wanted to make sure that students had access to what the system was providing. And that made sure that if there was extra time needed for assignments or for exams, that was already being kind of coordinated through the Center for Accessibility. The next thing would be to make sure that if you can't find what you need, to go to, you know, if you're an undergraduate student, go to the AMS. They are your alma mater. There's a number of resource groups that they support and work in a kind of like not quite independent but not dependent kind of way. So it's a little bit looser. And then if you're a graduate student, to go to the GSS. Partly because the AMS has advocates and so does the GSS. And so by kind of working within the system and really thinking about, you know, what is it that you need and how do you find advocacy, those are two really great places. And then I would say, check out what else is happening across the campus in terms of student groups, student clubs. I think the only reason why I got through my PhD with just a little wear and tear was because of the group of people that became my editors. And it was really important for me to have people who could read and edit my work. And I did the same for them. So it's, you know, it's amazing. I can read and edit other people's stuff. And my learning disability is very helpful because if I can't understand what's being said or written about, then there's something wrong. I can't always diagnose what's wrong in the writing. So I don't know if it's inside out. I don't know if it's, you know, the commas are in the wrong spot, what have you. But I can use it as a barometer. And then that's what I would really highly suggest to make sure that there's, you understand what the kind of system or structural supports are throughout the UBC system. And then, because that's not, you can't rely on that 100% of the time. So make sure that you understand what your social group and who how to make community, because the university can be pretty lonely, and it really is the colleagues that have helped me really get something out of my time as a graduate student.
Do you also have any stories about people who have are disabled or have adverse abilities and are seeking or interested in becoming trans or queer and how to navigate that? Like, you have stories about like how they found themselves or resources or and how, what challenges sometimes people like that face that you can share?
Yeah, so I think that so folks who are you know, either questioning whether it's their sexuality, their gender identity, what have you, are on that exploration journey and have a disability, it can limit the kinds of resources they can access. So I'm thinking about, you know, if somebody needs a care aid or there's always somebody else around, then it's unlikely that somebody will be able to access the different kinds of, you know, resources online, whether it's Pride UBC or Pride Collective, or I'm trying to think of, you know, there might be a couple of other groups that are kind of local to like, oh my goodness, community spelled with a Q, to other resources, you know, on the World Wide Web. And so if there's always somebody kind of hovering in the background, it can make it quite hard to do that exploration. And then also when connecting in with kind of broader 2S LGBTQIA plus groups, the sensitivity around disability sometimes isn't there. And so, you know, it can be tough kind of both ways, because if you're part of a community or you have, you know, good friends who understand the disability part, that feels really good, but maybe they won't be, or, you know, it's always a question, I think, of like, but if I'm questioning my sexuality or my gender identity, will they still want to hang out with me? Will they understand? Mm-hmm. Will they, you know, will they still be there if I transition or if I come out? And then on the other side, you know, the queer community is, so maybe I'll say it like this. For those who are part of the queer communities, levels of understanding and knowledge around disability, around disability justice, aren't always, they're uneven. And so, you know, people will have some different viewpoints. And so trying to find community there, there might be less of an understanding of disability and what's needed. So, and yet, this is the point I wanted to make. What I've seen in other research is that there's often an overlap between those who are advocating for themselves because they often need to do that regarding their disability. They then become more active in advocating for sexuality, gender, and those kinds of issues as well. And so I think it's interesting that the self-advocacy part is the part that's in common. And then needing to do it on a number of fronts or the ways in which disability and gender and sexual identities intersect is very interesting. And it's actually something that I would like to do some more reading and learning in, especially as I find myself there. Even though I identify as cisgender, I have been reading and learning about gender and sexuality since the late 90s. You know, there's still work to be done.
Very well said. So this is a little bit of a curveball question, but we're also on the topic of sexuality. Yeah. So why do you think society isn't comfortable with the idea of disabled people or having sex or being seen as sexy?
Oh, that is such a good question. And it is, it's, I think that there's a couple of different ideas that kind of get smashed together. So one is the kind of infantilizing of disabled folks, and it depends on the kind or type of disability. So if we're talking about developmental disability, that kind of quote unquote childlike state, like the connection into children and like, yeah, it just gets messy from there. So I'll just kind of contain it. So there's that, and whether or not, so then it leads into, can people with disabilities give consent, depending again on their disability? I think when it comes to physical disabilities, unless it fits that kind of conventional, depending on how much mobility somebody has, sometimes it's helpful. This is where we get into like sex swings and other kinds of supportive devices that can help. And then I think the other thing is, and I feel pretty confident in saying this from my own research and my own studies, is that when sex moves further and further away from penis and vagina, heterosexual, I mean, you know, let's be even more extravagant and say, you know, missionary style sex that, you know, ought to be happening in a monogamous, hopefully married, children reproducing way. So the further away we move from that, the more likely that kind of sex will be stigmatized. And so if people are not using that we can use different body parts, I think is really important. And that there's attachments, I think is really important. And I have to say, I'm pretty sex positive. And so I really would encourage people, if they have that desire and they want to use their bodies and feel that kind of pleasure, and that's good for them, great. I also know that there's folks out there who identify as asexual, and that might not necessarily align. And so it's always, always 100% about consent, and about, you know, doing the things that you like with people you like, because they also like doing them too. And it always has to be consensual, and it's not just like maybe consensual, it's 100% excited, enthusiastic, consensual.
I guess like the next question I have is, like, how would a young person or with a disability, or even a person who becomes disabled later in life, explore their sexual identity or their sexual preferences in a safe environment? And that environment being the right people, you know, and I think I always worry about like being taken advantage of. And you just, and it also, if you want to explore, like you're saying about, you know, what you might like, how do you find that person who is like also attracted or into it? Like, how does a person navigate and explore those kind of things?
Oh my goodness. That's such a good question. It's such a good question that I'm not sure I have a great answer. What's coming to mind is that, there's kind of two ideas. So one, I think that the idea that there's just, you know, people just have like one love in their life, and that we're like waiting for that one love, or that we're, you know, we're holding ourselves back so that we can meet that one person. I think we have to throw that away. I think that people have great loves in their life. And part of it is finding people that are worth the vulnerability. And I think the thing, and I don't know exactly who this is from, so it's, I've picked it up kind of along the way, but it's this idea that, you know, the people that are acquaintances, we just say hey to, you know, they're kind of more on the outside of our kind of like spheres. The next kind of level in is like the activity is kind of more important than the person, but the person likes to do that activity too. So, you know, so you do that one thing together. And then the next level in is good friends. And good friends, it doesn't matter what you do. You just want to spend time with that person. And then there's your inner circle. And these are really trusted people who would love you even if you're really effed up, and that you would love, and I don't mean in that like sexual way, but like in the always, that if they really effed up, you'd still love them anyways. So, you know, I think it's about finding people in all of those areas and really understanding when somebody is worthy of moving closer to that inner circle. And then it's always about open conversation and being honest. And even though it's really tricky and really scary, and like, it could mean rejection, but if you're interested in, you know, wanting to try or experiment, to like, just be upfront about it. And then if the answer is no, right, because we want to build consent, then being okay with that. And what does it mean, or what does it look like to be okay with a no? And I think if those skills could be something that could be part of school, you know, from kindergarten on up, it means that once we hit university, this would be practice. We would just be practicing these things. They wouldn't be things that we're learning sometimes for the first time, depending on who we are and how we grew up.
I'm going to ask you about Atypical. Did you see the Netflix TV show?
Yep.
About like, yeah, the kid who he's on the spectrum, and he's this like young adult, and he goes through all young adult things, like, you know, moving out or dating or like getting your first job or like going to school and figuring out like applying to universities and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that show?
I have two thoughts. Okay. So one, I thought it was such an interesting representation of what, so because there's like, yeah, there's a couple of different avenues. So it was interesting in watching a family and how has this family stayed together, come apart, while trying to support, to support his ability to like
Sam. Progress.
That's right, Sam. So that I think is really interesting, important. The way that his sister is, you know, his biggest tormentor and also biggest champion. And I think it showed the complexity. At the same time, I'm also, aware of, you know, what does it mean for, because Sam is not the only person, so male, cis, white person on the spectrum out there in TV land. And so what happens when we get into issues of representation, when that is kind of one of the only ways in which we see this represented. Also on Netflix, which is about this gay guy who has cerebral palsy and his kind of navigating leaving the nest and moving out on his own, was also really fascinating. And yet, you know, I have to say there's something about white men and how they get to be the center of these types of shows. And yet it was fascinating to see the representation of cerebral palsy in a way that I had not seen it before.
We're going to need to make like a all access pass watch list for all of these.
Yes, because I was just going to talk about the TV show with this black kid with asthma and his best friend is a girl with osteo something imperfecta in a wheelchair, and she's like 7 years old. She actually has a disability, and they like go around like fighting superheroes, but like, you know, and they're like not the girl, like a cute little white girl, but the kid's like this like awesome black kid. And so yeah, we should need to review all
interesting
these.
Agreed.
Yeah. One last question, what does accessibility mean to you?
Ooh, good question. Accessibility means what I need when I need it. I don't need everything all the time, and that has to do with the way that my chronic illness works, is that I always love using the terms remitting and relapsing, but that's not actually, that probably, it's just ebbs and flows. And so sometimes I need additional support and sometimes I'm good. And so accessibility is making sure that I can make that choice for myself because I have options. When there aren't options, I don't get to choose, and that's not very accessible. So for me, that's what accessibility means.
I love that answer, and I totally agree with that. All right, so that's going to be the end of the interview. Is there anything you want to say to our listeners? We're also going to be dropping this on Global Accessibility Awareness Day, so... if there's any final words you want to say to our listeners, feel free to do so.
Oh, that's such a great opportunity. I wish I had thought about it. I would say just keep showing up. Whoever you are, whatever you're doing, don't stop. You make a difference. Sometimes you can't know how you make a difference, but you do. And I thank you for that.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I love that.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like we can keep talking to you because we have so many more questions.
Thank you so much for the invite.
Yeah, hopefully we can get you on some other time and we can run through some more questions, you know, catch up on, you know, so much the new shows coming out, you know.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, perfect. All right, well, that's our episode. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
This is Sasha Bilott, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Sometimes the internet makes me cry at night. Sometimes I cry at night looking at the internet. Sometimes the internet makes me cry. cry at night. Sometimes when I go to bed, I just want to cry. Sometimes the internet makes me cry at night. Sometimes I cry at night looking at the internet. Sometimes the internet makes me cry at night. Sometimes when I go to bed, I just want to cry. Sometimes the internet makes me cry at night. Sometimes I cry at night looking at the internet.
visitors who make you feel arousy. They only change your mind when you get cozy. Perception of time don't always know how you feel. Direction of sense don't always show you what's real. If I could only show you what you showed me, then love wouldn't be nothing that it could be. And that's when my heart stops and drops in my heels. I'll never forget all the hurt that I feel. She told me not to.
Bye. Hi, I'm Hannah Imam, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. This is Forgotten British Columbia, a series on the history of the province that has been erased and those that have been forgotten. Today, we will talk about the Chinese head tax. A brief content warning. The following episode contains themes of racism and xenophobia against the Chinese community that some may find distressing. If so, you can come back to 101.9 in 5 minutes. Others, we encourage you to listen. The infamous head tax essentially discriminated against Chinese people living in Canada and those wanting to come here in search of better work opportunities. Under the Chinese Immigration Act of 1885, the Canadian government charged a head tax of $50 to discourage Chinese immigration. The unjust policies had grave consequences on families, separating them for generations.
Both my grandfathers on my mother and father's side paid the head tax, and both my grandfathers were separated from their wives for a period of 2 decades and more.
That was Sid Chow Tan.
One of the legacies of all this comes out of what is called heathens without souls. We were treated, that is, the Chinese were treated the way we were treated because we weren't seen as human.
He is the co-founder of the Head Tax Families Society of Canada. Similar to his grandfathers, many Chinese men suffered from exclusion and loneliness because bringing their families to Canada was not a privilege afforded to most. In Vancouver, Chinese immigrants weren't allowed to buy property outside Chinatown, and so very quickly Chinatown became their safe haven where they practiced their culture, spoke their language, and conducted business. Chinese residents lived like second-class citizens, as they weren't allowed to vote, apply for citizenship, work professional jobs, and were essentially prohibited from exercising basic civil rights. Let's take a few steps back and look at where this began. The exclusionary policies are directly tied to the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway, also known as CPR, a transcontinental railway which would directly connect Eastern Canada to BC. The CPR proved to be a major milestone in the development on what is colonially known as Canada. Around 17,000 Chinese laborers were brought from China to work on the railroad, proving instrumental in the construction of the CPR. They worked in harsh conditions and were paid $1 a day, less than what their white counterparts earned, which was between $1.50 to $2. It is estimated that some 1,000 Chinese workers died in the building of the railway. Regardless of their contributions, soon after the completion of the project, Canadian authorities imposed the head tax in order to discourage Chinese immigration. The head tax was raised to $100 in 1900 and to $500 in 1903, equivalent to 2 years of wages. The Chinese Canadian National Council says the federal government acquired a total of $23 million from the head tax levies, of which about $8.5 million were collected by the BC government. Records show that an estimate of 82,000 people from China bore the brunt of the regressive head tax from 1885 to 1923. Despite severe barriers, the Chinese population continued to grow in the country, and particularly in BC in the early 1900s. In 1923, the Canadian government further curtailed restrictions and imposed the Chinese Exclusion Act, completely banning Chinese citizens from entering Canada. Yet, around 300 Chinese living in Canada volunteered to fight in World War I, and this number doubled during the Second World War. The service of the Chinese veterans during the war played a pivotal role and put pressure on the state to grant the Chinese community full rights, and at last, the Chinese Exclusion Act was revoked in 1947. In 2006, Stephen Harper's government apologized for the racist laws and made payments of $20,000 each to living head tax payers or their surviving spouses. However, the redress was criticized because it was superficial and only redressed 800 families, leaving out thousands of families who didn't have a surviving member at that time. In the past year, many activists and journalists have drawn parallels between the rise in anti-Asian racism and aggression towards Asians during COVID-19 and the looming anti-Asian sentiment that was prevalent during the inception of Canada and the United States.
I think one of the hardest things for most Canadians to understand, because they haven't been taught this history in school books, and often people who find out about it, they read on their own, they learn about it by hearing from people who were interned, if they're Japanese Canadian, or people who went through the residential schooling experience. One of the most difficult things for most Canadians is understanding the legacies of that long history of white supremacy.
As Henry Yu, a history professor at UBC, reminds us, history lessons in schools are filled with omissions and erasures. Having said that, it is also key to continuously reject the notion that racism is a thing only in the past and doesn't exist anymore, because in reality, it is woven in the fabric of Canada that is built on colonialism, white supremacy, and stolen land. Only then do we have some prospect of disrupting false narratives and holding power to account. Today's episode was written and edited by me, Hanaima. This show is co-produced by Karen Saxena and myself, Hanaima. The music for Forgotten British Columbia is by Cron Fused. You can also listen to the show online by visiting CIDR.ca and searching Forgotten British Columbia.
We lived on Grave Street. Fashion, are you?
hope you're doing great. Today we're joined by Stephanie and Jacqueline from Opera Mariposa, and we're super excited to have both of you on our show. Can you tell us a little about yourselves?
Well, my name is Jacqueline Coe. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm the founding artistic director of Opera Mariposa. I'm an operatic soprano, a model, and an ME/CFS advocate. I've been producing shows since I was 16, and I founded Opera Mariposa at age